Support for WGTD's morning show comes from Jack Andrea, featuring unique shopping, and the historic Jack's Cafe, featuring an eclectic menu. A Kenosha tradition since 1911. Modernized for a new age, visit jackandrea.com for more information. The Morning Show with Greg Berg is next.
The next few minutes of WGTD's morning show will be spent in the water, so to speak. Spent swimming, so to speak. That is, we are going to... The next few minutes of WGTD's morning show will be spent in the water, so to speak. Spent swimming, so to speak. That is, we are going to be exploring what turns out to be the 10,000-year history of swimming, courtesy of a fascinating new book that has just been published by Hachette, and it is called Splash, 10,000 Years of Swimming. The author is Howard Means, who has written a number of different books before this, some very fine works of nonfiction. But in this particular case, Howard Means is combining his sharp skills as a writer with his lifelong love of swimming, a competitive swimmer himself since the age of 5. And so this, as it says in his biography, this particular book is a labor of love, perhaps in a way that nothing else he has written has been to the same extent. Howard Means was a senior editor at Washingtonian Magazine for a time, and a very busy columnist and freelance journalist. Again, the author or co-author of 10 books, the most recent of which is Splash, 10,000 Years of Swimming. Howard Means, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thanks very much for having me.
I absolutely loved your book, and I say that as someone who knows how to swim but has not swum in many, many years, never swam competitively, never even thought about it. So this is, in some respects, a world I did not know very, very much about and knew nothing of the history of swimming whatsoever. So there's just so much to enjoy here, and one does not need to be an avid swimmer in order, I think, to find this book really, really interesting. In fact, I wonder, you as somebody who has been an avid swimmer for nearly all of your life, I suspect that that doesn't necessarily mean that you had any reason to know much of what you end up exploring in this book. I mean, how much of this book, in terms of the research of it, was a voyage of discovery for you?
That's a great question, and in fact, you're absolutely right. I mean, I thought this was going to be a labor of love. I thought, you know, they always say write about what you know, and every other book I've done was kind of a journey of discovery, which made it fun for me. And I thought, well, this will be one I can just sit back and write off the top, not off the top of my head, but right from my heart. And every time I turned the corner in this book, I was discovering how much I didn't know, not how much I did know. I was just constantly surprised. And then it would give me something to explore, and I'd explore that. Then I'd be surprised again. I mean, from the very beginning, I set out to find out, you know, I just set the goal of finding what's the oldest known reference to swimming in literature and anywhere. And that's when I stumbled upon the Cave of the Swimmers in the southwest Egyptian desert, where the oldest known cave paintings or pictographs of swimmers can be found. And this is the Eastern Sahara. It's what's known now as the Great Sand Sea. And then I found out that that is now officially the driest spot on Earth as measured by the aridity index, which is the chance a drop of rain has of surviving once it hits the ground. And it has basically no chance of Wadi Sura in the southwest Egyptian desert. So then you ask yourself, well, why? Why is this where the paintings are? And then you find out that the Earth had wobbled on its axis about 4,000 years before, about 12,000 years ago, and all those rains we associate with the Congo, the Central Africa area, moved up, and the Sahara for about 4,000 years became a perfectly charming place, filled with rivers and lakes and lots of evidence of big aquatic animals. For example, Nile perch were living there, hippopotami were living there, all that. And obviously, from these cave paintings, there are many of them in there. They're all doing a very relaxed doggy paddle. They knew how to swim. The artist had seen people swim, and so they were swimming in these waters. And I thought, well, that's a place to start the book. And I just kept, every time I turned a corner, something like that was happening.
I love that. In the prologue, you write that, like any activity that dates back to the dawn of humankind, swimming is an index of change, of social mores, of fashion, of how we relate to nature, of religious teachings and superstitions, of sport and how we judge performance, and most notably, in the case of the this Cave of the Swimmers, climatological change. And, you know, in that little paragraph, you're really touching on the fact that when one is writing about a subject like swimming,
right,
it touches on a myriad of other areas and other disciplines.
Yeah.
And so this book ends up being, in a sense, about a lot more than just swimming itself, but it's about
Absolutely.
The people who have
yeah.
have been swimmers all through the centuries.
Yeah, and it's also, in one critical sense, this is something I had no idea about, the golden age of swimming, I say in the book, and I'm sure it's right, was the ancient civilizations, Greek, Roman, and Egyptian civilizations. It sort of figures they were, you know, Mediterranean civilizations. It's hard not to dive in the Mediterranean on a summer day. And so Plato, for example, said that a man isn't educated unless he can read, write, and swim. Imagine that. It's a wonderful statement. I love it. So Rome falls, you know, the Roman Empire collapses in the middle of the 5th century A.D., and swimming absolutely disappears from Europe for 1,000 years. I mean, there are you know, minor examples of it here and there. Charlemagne liked to swim, apparently. But to think that a whole realm of human activity and something as pleasant and enjoyable as swimming could simply disappear from the entire continent, it just amazed me. And so that, again, opened up another window of exploration, of course, why. And I get into that in some detail in the book. It had to do with – and so when people resume an interest in swimming in the sort of late 17th, 18th, and early 19th centuries in England, because they're interested, they become newly interested in the ancient civilizations, and they realize people swam there. It's not that they don't know how to swim. They have no idea how to even go in the water. There are these books written called The Art of Swimming, and there are about 10 of them with the same title. And the first thing they have to do is convince people it's okay just to go in water, not to even lie down in the water and try to swim. So it's just, I mean, it just fascinated me.
I want to delve into some specifics, but first I want to shift to the personal for a moment, if I could.
Sure.
And I should say, you know, you touch on your own life as a swimmer at a couple of points in the book, but not extensively. I mean, that's not what this book is about. This is not a memoir about my life as a swimmer. But you say a couple of things that are really intriguing, and we even have a couple of photographs of you as a youngster and you as a high school student.
Right.
And you make, you know, mention in at a couple different points about your life as a swimmer. I wonder if you could just talk for a moment about what it was that drew you to swimming and from such a young age, and what drew you to the pool to be a competitive swimmer and to devote
right.
what I would assume would be untold hours and untold amounts of energy in this particular pursuit.
Yeah, and to absorb untold amounts of chlorine over the course
right.
of my life, too, I should add. There's sometimes when I sweat, I smell like chlorine. So, well, my mother would... summers, my mother liked to play bridge, and she would park us. She would just park herself beside the pool, and there were three of us. I was the youngest of the kids, and we would just have about 5 hours to, you know, in the pool, and we wouldn't leave the pool except to you know, for the necessities of nature periodically. And so, you know, there were just a whole bunch of us who did this, and I had some success at it. I not because I was the best swimmer, because I had a skill set that was better. I won my first race when I was 5 years old, and I was the only one of the probably 10 of us lined up for a race across the pool who could dive into the water. Everybody else had to jump in and push off the wall. So I had this great advantage.
Oh, yeah.
And I managed to come out ahead on the other end. And then I just kept doing it. I had some success at it. And I swam through high school, swam through college. But it's more than that. It's just an environment that, you know, it's an environment that I'm graceful in. I'm not particularly graceful on land. If I try to water ski, I fall down a lot of times. It's just something, maybe because I've done it so much from an early age. But I love the weightless environment. I love being out in the middle of a lake one shore, no land within a quarter of a mile and 100 feet of water below me. That sort of sensory deprivation you get, and it's just you and the water and the sun beating down on you. I've always loved body surfing, even when I busted my shoulder and almost broke my neck about 6 years ago doing it. So it's just the Mayur, it's a medium in which I feel complete, I guess is what I would say.
Right. In fact, early in the prologue, you say the near weightlessness of swimming is the closest most of us will ever get to zero gravity space travel. And you also say the terror of being submerged is the nearest some of us will ever come to sheer hell. I want to just follow up on one thing. As you describe, the joy of singing,
as you don't want me to sing, trust me.
All right. As you describe the joy of swimming, I can relate perfectly. What is harder for me to understand as an outsider looking in is how anybody can love the hours upon hours upon hours that a competitive swimmer must devote to this, in part because compared to hours of football practice or baseball practice, it just looks like hours and hours and hours of the same thing. It just looks so tedious.
Drudgery, is it that back and forth,
Is it as tedious as it looks, or is there something more interesting about it that the rest of us on land looking at you are missing?
I hated nothing more in life than pushing a blocking sled when I tried after the high school football team. That was awful as far as I was concerned. I think what happens to swimmers, and maybe this happens to long-distance runners too, there's a kind of a zen to going back and forth and back and forth. I was swimming the other day. I did a mile on the little pool around here. And I guess I was thinking about this because somebody asked me, what's it like to do that time again, turn and turn? And I don't even think about that. It's the same stroke. I'm doing the same motion repetitively. And so once I'm doing that, I can sort of lose myself in it. And I'm a writer, and so, I have a lot of time where I'm just trying to figure out what I'm going to say next in a chapter or a paragraph. And it's when I swim that I get a lot of what I think is called unconscious resolution, because I'm doing something that is repetitive and it frees my mind to go anywhere it wants to go. And for me, at least, at any rate, it's therapy. And this last 2.5 months when I couldn't get in the water because of the coronavirus was kind of a... I was on edge a lot of that time, not because of the virus, but because I just didn't have this time when I sort of disappeared into myself, as you do, I think, when you swim laps or swim long distance. Because you really are in a sensory deprivation tank, almost.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, especially if you're in open water and you can't see anything around you.
In chapter one of your book, and again, for those just joining us, I'm speaking with Howard Means about his book, Splash, 10,000 Years of Swimming. You, in chapter one, talk about some of the ways in which there is, in your words, something genetically aquatic about us humans. And when I first kind of glanced at these words, I just assumed you were just going to tell us what we've already know, that most of our body is composed of water. But you aren't talking about that at all. You're talking about some very interesting ways in which we seem to have been created for the water. Tell our listeners about some of the more interesting aspects of this.
Well, let's start with infants. Until the age of about 6 months, kids, their windpipe naturally closes when they go underwater. That's the secret of the water babies classes they teach at WISE and things like that. I mean, that's a wonderful survival skill, but it may come because we're aquatic mammals in the womb. Until the moment of birth, we're basically aquatic mammals. But there are all these sort of mammalian diving reflexes and things that happen to your body when you're submerged in water. Your heart rate slows down. Your pulse rate slows down. There's some wonderful research that was in something called the Journal of Circumpolar Swimming, I think was the name of it. You can imagine there's a publication by that name. And remember, this is circumpolar. This is the poles, North and South Pole. That the dramatic effects on rheumatism, arthritis, et cetera, in this water, which is in the 40 degrees, which is very uncomfortable for most of us. And one thing really interesting in that fact, too, and this goes to some of the larger issues, women, the further the race goes and the colder the water, the greater the advantage women have. Because they have subcutaneous fat in greater quantities than men, so it's a kind of natural insulation. And seals, porpoises, whales have this too. And then the mammalian diving reflex, which just shuts down your body as you go. If you go, you know, there are these sort of super divers now that go down 700-800 feet using sleds and various things to get them down there. But it would be impossible without what happens to the body as you go down underwater. Your external limbs, your external parts of your body shut down, and everything shunts to the core of your body, your brain and your heart. And you have this incredible, massive pressure on you the further down you go. And that is a mammalian aquatic mammal response. That's why whales can go down as deeply as they do. So there are all these. Oh, and then the other thing was. Oh, this has really fascinated me. When you're underwater, you don't hear with your ear, obviously, in the normal way that sound travels. You hear by bone conduction. There's you know the waves travel through the water and the bones carry it to your ear and you interpret that as sound. And that's why underwater you can hear pinging really far off. If somebody taps a hammer a quarter of a mile away or half a mile away, you can hear it. But that's the same way that whales and porpoises make sound. So at some level, we retain the capacity to hear these things, which I think goes back to our aquatic past.
Mm. Speaking of the past, I mean, it is really astonishing to think about how far back into the past we can go to find reference to swimmers. And, of course, we've already talked about the ancient drawings on the walls of the so-called Cave of the Swimmers and other instances in which swimming appears to be depicted in the artwork of, for instance, ancient Egypt and so on.
Yes, but I think, absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah, fascinating. But I think we should actually move ahead, if we can, to
sure.
to what you again call swimming's golden age, the classical period of ancient mm-hmm. Greece and ancient Rome. And I think this is going to be for many people an enormous surprise to find out that swimming had such a treasured place in the life of ancient Greece and ancient Rome to some extent as well. Tell us more about the centrality of swimming and how that folds into everything else that we understand about ancient Greece and ancient Rome.
Right. Well, for the Greeks, it was a military skill. It was treasured as a military skill. And in fact, it was a determinant, turning Herodotus, the great Greek historian, it was a determining factor in many battles when they were battling the Persians and under Xerxes and other times because the barbarians, of course, they were always called if they weren't Greeks, they might have an equal chance when one battleship was against another. But once sailors, you know, had to go into the water, the Greeks could swim to another boat, they could swim to shore, and the Persians, whoever else, they just drowned wholesale. They couldn't get 40 yards to the shore. They couldn't get 40 yards from the shore to a boat just offshore. So it was treasured as a military skill, but it was also obviously done for just the sheer pleasure of it. There's this wonderful. It's the interior of a sarcophagus in the Campania section area of Italy, central southern Italy, that shows this. And it's from about, I think it's about 500 or 600 BC. I'm sorry, I don't have the date in front of me. This guy just diving off of a wall, a beautiful kind of swan dive into the Mediterranean, and it's presumably the guy who's lying in the sarcophagus dead. Maybe he's diving into the underworld, but it's a beautiful painting of this guy, and it was obviously treasured for the form of the human body. And the Greeks swam naked. The Romans were a little reluctant to go completely skinny dipping, but they finally did as the empire went on. But the Romans were engineers, and the genius of the Roman Empire really was their waterworks, the aqueducts that carried water, you know, all sorts of places, the baths, the thermal baths, and you see the sort of some of that preserved in Pompeii. You see it also in Bath in England, where they built baths when they finally conquered England. It was the heart of the civic life of these baths. People would go to them midday, day after day after day, and they would, in some cases, they'd swim, in some cases, they'd soak. But it was central to their life. And what happened with the collapse of the Roman Empire is the engineering of the Romans collapsed too. And so this idea of bringing fresh water from great distances collapsed. Sanitation collapsed. The Romans used water too to take waste matter away from cities. So all that collapsed, and with that swimming collapsed, because I think swimming was central. The engineering was central to the swimming. The swimming was central to the engineering. They sort of self-fed each other.
And so, as you have already touched on, there is this long period in history, not long after the fall of the Roman Empire, where so much of this falls away. And we're not talking about 1,000 years where nobody ever swam, but it lost its place in sort of the central part of life. And you cite several different contributing factors to this.
Yeah, just a couple of them. One was the failure of the engineering. I mean, it's the Romans kept the banks of rivers from overflowing. I mean, it was like happened to, in the U.S. when the army the Civil War, when the Army Corps of Engineers stopped doing the banks, you know, tending to the banks of the Mississippi. You had these huge floods, and the same thing. So it was that. There was also this idea of communal living. I mean, the baths, at least for the Romans, and not for their slaves, unfortunately, the enslaved people they brought back to Rome, but it was a communal activity, and communal activities just completely disappeared. Royalty disappeared into their castles during the Dark and Middle Ages. The church disappeared into its strongholds, its monasteries. And the idea of communal living simply disappeared. And that's what reemerged so powerfully in America in the 20th century. And pools were a big part of that, too. We'll get to that later, maybe. And then there was the religious element of it, the uses to which swimming was put. Beginning about the 16th century, maybe a little bit before, and into in America the 1730s, one of the ways you determine whether someone was a witch was they did what they called swimming a witch. And they would take a witch and they would tie her right thumb to her left toe and her left thumb to her right toe. They'd tie a rope around her and throw her into a mill pond. Now, if she sunk, you'd think that would mean she was a witch. But no, if they sunk, they pulled her out. If she floated on the water, that was proof that she was a witch because it tied back to the ritual of baptism, and those who had not been baptized would not be accepted into the water. So the worst thing that could happen was you could float, and that pretty much meant you were heading to the stake to be burned. and it actually favored overweight witches considerably because they were inclined. I mean, sorry, it favored scrawny people considerably because they sank more readily than overweight people.
Hmm.
So if you're going to be a witch, it was better to be a scrawny witch.
Wow. So in a chapter called Rediscovering a Lost Art, you point to some of the interesting works of poetry and literature that highlighted swimming and helped to, in a sense, bring it back into the mainstream. And you have obviously explored a lot of these works extensively. And I want you to take a moment to talk about one of the most fascinating, which is, I believe, titled The Art of Swimming by Everard Digby. Am I remembering this correctly?
You've got it exactly right, yeah.
From 1587. And you tell us that reading The Art of Swimming is like traveling via time machine to some distant primitive epoch in history when cave dwellers still had no word for wet. So tell us.
I like that sentence.
I do too. So tell our listeners about the context within which works like The Art of Swimming were being written and shared with the public.
Digby, Everard Digby was the first person to really, he wasn't the first person to write about swimming, but he was the first person to make to do a systematic effort. And he's one of those people that I was talking about that a lot of the opening part of that book is really about how to get into the water. And he has all these bizarre ways to get in the water. You run to the water and you do a kind of a backflip and land in the water. But once you get in the water, he does provide minimal instruction on how to various things you can do in the water. He liked decorative swimming. He had all these woodcuts. He has about 40 woodcuts in the book. And one shows somebody lying on their back in the water and paring their toenails with a knife while they lie there. I don't recommend trying that, by the way. I gave it a go, and it's really impossible to do. Or rolling like a roach. But it has some things that look like elementary backstroke and look sort of like basic breaststroke, too. But Digby was a Cambridge professor, and when he wrote this, they were caning students at Cambridge who tried to swim in the local river, which I guess the Camp, if memory serves me. I think that's why it's called Cambridge. And they were drowning in great numbers, perhaps because they were college students. There was a certain amount of adult beverage was involved, too, when they got in the water. But it got so bad, finally, that the provost decreed that any student who went in the water would be caned. So Digby, I think, was trying to provide both a general introduction to swimming and provide a public service. You know, people should learn to swim because your chances of drowning are considerably less if you know how to swim than if you don't. And it was a very influential book. It was copied, really, by a Frenchman named Thévenot, and one among the readers of that book was Benjamin Franklin. And Franklin learned everything he knew about swimming from Thévenot, and Franklin then became one of the ardent proponents of swimming, both in England and back in America. So it had a long-lasting effect.
Right. And in the following chapter, chapter 5, which you title Swimming 2.0, you tell us that the revival of swimming in the Western world owes much to three very different men, Lord Byron, Richard Russell, and Benjamin Franklin.
I love the story about Franklin. So he lived in Boston as a kid and spent a lot of time in the water because he hated working for his father. And by about age 21, he's living in London, apprenticing at a printer's. And one of the guys that he's working with says, "Gee, he'd love to learn to swim." And Franklin says, "You've asked just the man." So he teaches this guy and a friend of his to swim. He says, "I think in two lessons." And then about a week or two later, he and this guy and some other people are walking along the bank of the Thames. And this guy tells the other guys that what an excellent swimmer Franklin is, and they say, "Oh, can we see some performance?" And Franklin strips naked on the spot and dives into the river and swims about 3 miles with the current behind him, doing all these tricks that he's learned from reading Digby via Sevenoe, rolling in the water and various other things he did. And he says that, and that became, the word of that got around, and he was offered a chance to teach a very wealthy man's sons. And he said he thought by the response that he could have made a handsome living in London as a swimming teacher, but he came back to the States instead, thus changing both the history of swimming and America, probably.
No kidding.
I
want to be sure to ask you about something in the following chapter called A Frog in Every Tub, in which you point out something that is so hard to imagine, and that is that apparently for many, many, many years, there was quite a debate among swimming scholars and experts on whether or not swimming was best done as a sport horizontally or vertically. I mean, it's nearly unimaginable to think about.
It's absolutely unimaginable.
Right. So first of
and
all,
I can't believe the proponent of that. It was an Italian ever tried it.
Right. So explain what is behind this interesting debate that was in the air at least for a while.
Well, yes, because there was no stored knowledge of swimming. All these various techniques came, and this guy, the Frenchman, I mean the Italian, said, well, you know, man is naturally upright when he performs activities, and so he should be naturally upright doing this. And then he claimed that he had swum a mile and, oh, I forget what it was, 18 minutes, maybe something like that. Well, it wasn't until the 1940s that Olympic mile was swum faster than that. And I think it was just because, oh, well, and of course, he was swimming as seahorses swim. Seahorses are the only animal that swims upright. And there was no sense to it, but it was still popular because they thought they were imitating, the natural world when they did that. This is how we're meant to swim because we're an upright beast to begin with. So all that stuff, and it just, these crackpot theories came one after the other, and I just love reading about them.
For those
I love writing about them, too.
Yeah,
after that.
Evidently. For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Howard Means, and we are talking about his fascinating book called Splash, 10,000 Years of Swimming. And we are really just touching on just some of the high points of this of this book, which really explores swimming in extraordinary detail and with all kinds of different fashions. I think it's important for us to talk for a moment about the rise of both public swimming pools and private swimming pools, and the kind of the rise and fall and ebb and flow and so of the, which is really quite intriguing. I mean that it is a badge of accomplishment when someone can afford to have a beautiful private pool in their own backyard, and of course it is another swath of the public that is served by public swimming pools, and they both have mattered a lot in this history.
Right. This is also an expression of community. That chapter I titled Swimming Together, Swimming Alone, for the progression of the chapter. But in the 1920s in America, these magnificent, the roaring 20s, huge pools were built in almost every major city in the country. The Fleischacker Pool in San Francisco was a saltwater pool that was so large there were rowboats with lifeguards going up and down the pool. I mean, these were huge, huge facilities. New York had a bunch of them. And basically, St. Louis had two. Every major city in the country had, and my own hometown of Lancaster, Pennsylvania, had two large pools like that. And I lifeguarded at one of them, and I swam in a swim team at the other one. And they were, let's say you could have, well, in some of them, the Fleischacker Pool, as I remember, claimed that it could have 10,000 people in a time in it.
Wow.
And everybody would still have 300 gallons of water to themselves, something like that. I forget exactly the figures. It was an amazing number. And then a couple things happen. One, the country club movement comes along, and that it's sort of built around golf, which becomes a very popular sport. But they were sort of scrubby little golf courses, a lot of them, and then they sort of the country club movement, and the country clubs had pools, of course, to make it a sort of a mini resort, and that drew away kind of the upper middle class from a lot of these pools, which lessened their municipal support as it went along. And then from the country club movement, we get to, well, the Depression enters in there, but not as much as you would think. There were a lot of pools built during the Depression by the Works Progress Administration, because swimming was thought to be, by a poll of psychologists and sports psychologists, whatever the term would have been in those days, it was deemed to be the most healthy sport for youth in America.
And of course, you mentioned the fact that President Franklin Delano Roosevelt, for understandable reasons, was devoted to swimming, and his leadership probably was helpful as well.
Right. Yeah. Exactly. And then along comes World War II and the creation of the suburbs, and the suburbs start to build, you know, community-based pools. So there are, you know, 17 blocks have a pool around a pool. So those sort of large, big urban pools become segmented, compartmentalized into communities. And then Shot Creek and Gunite create these sort of, you can now, instead of having 300 gallons to yourself at the Fleischecker pool, you can have 300 gallons to yourself in your own backyard, with a tiki bar at the end, maybe, or something like that. And so it's ever and ever smaller quantities until now you have resistance pools, you know, one-person pools at the house. And then simultaneously, too, you have the whole – you have the issue of integration and segregation of pools. Pools are really the last taboo on segregation. Long after lunch counters, there was a – you know, it was hard to – there were battles going over these before lunch counters and after lunch counters. There were battles going on, so they're an index of how people live, of society as well as of sports.
Right, and it's interesting. You explore how, you know, there are certain theories about how there was something about the swimming pool, and of course by the mid 20th century, you have people that are wearing very little, and And so there was this sense of intense vulnerability when, for instance, you had blacks and whites together, and you say especially
black men
and white women and so on. And for some backward-thinking people, this segregation they held on to with great ferocity. I appreciate that you explore that. And you share some interesting numbers about how in 1900 there were 67 public swimming pools in the United States, and now there are more than 360,000. So that tells us how drastically the landscape changes in this respect.
Exactly. Go ahead.
I touched on the fact that what people wear when they swim changed drastically over the years. I mean, there's centuries go by where most swimming is, as far as we can tell, was done in the nude. And then in Chapter 9, you outline what you call the great swimming cover-up, in which that changes drastically, and especially what is permitted for women to wear when they are swimming. Tell us more about what women had to endure if they were interested in swimming.
Oh, these swimming dresses they had. I mean, the idea was you should show as little skin as possible. And so they would swimming dresses. There were often gloves they would wear and hats. And at least in the beaches in England, Brighton and Margate and people like that, they had these conveyances. And so a woman would go in. They go into a dressing room, and they would often drink salt water because of a salt water cure that had become very popular. That's where Richard Russell enters into the story. And then they would be horse-drawn, the carriages, and they would take them out into the water, and you know, far enough for them to dunk once they get out of the other end. They get out at the other end so nobody from the shore could see them, and they put a little umbrella down, or a canopy down over the door. And then they'd be lowered into the water by dunkers, women who would wait out there, and they'd hold them and they'd push them underwater three times, probably because of the Father, Son, and Holy Ghost, the baptism rite again. And then they would be back in, and they'd go back in, and they'd come fully dressed again. But nothing was showing, and nothing was allowed. Men were different. Men sort of went out in the same conveyances, but they would strip naked as they went out and get out the other end, where women couldn't see them, and swim naked for a while and get back in. But these conveyances, these clothes, these bathing costumes, for example, the dresses would have lead weights sewn into the hem, so they couldn't rise up and, you know, and expose the leg. They wouldn't float up and expose the leg. Well, it also it makes it almost impossible to swim. If you even if you wanted to swim and tried to kick with a lead weight, it'd be like, you know, a resistance training, I think, today. So you know, and that goes. I mean, as late as the 1930s, and the same in men. You know, it didn't have to wear quite that many clothes, but as late as the 1930s, men were not allowed to wear what looked like wrestling unitards. Now. They couldn't show anything below the armpits, basically. There was a sort of a scoop neck, but they were cover-ups. Women's two-piece suits start to become, well, actually it's the Janssen Knitting Company in Portland, Oregon that changes all this, and they finally produce, well, let me go back one step further. There's an Australian woman named Annette Kellerman.
Oh, my gosh. What a story.
Isn't she spectacular?
Yes.
Oh, I love that woman. she's my favorite chapter in the book, practically. But she's the one who really changes what women are required to wear. And she was a terrific swimmer in Australia, where she's from. She was a terrific entertainer. And one day at Revere Beach in the, I think it was 1907, she decided she wasn't going to take it anymore, and she shows up at Revere Beach wearing a one-piece suit without a skirt to cover her legs and without anything on her arms. And she's promptly arrested, as I think she might have hoped to be and maybe planned to be. So she goes before the judge for indecent exposure, and she says, "Why should I have to swim in more clothes than I can hang on a clothesline at one time? And, you know, and women are dying because of this." And the judge agrees with her. And he lets her off without a fine on the any requirement that she wear a cape to the water's edge next time. Soon there is launched an Annette Kellerman swimsuit called, and Annette Kellerman laughs all the way to the bank, and she changes women's swimwear forever at that moment, in that very moment. And she goes on to a wildly successful career in Hollywood and various other places. But she's a really neat person.
The title of this chapter where you explore her is called "An Aussie Wrecking Ball Goes Rogue." That tells us a whole lot about how she was put together. It's a great story.
I love that. Well,
yeah.
Thanks.
I do want to say that among many other interesting things you explore is, of course, competitive swimming, of which you have had quite a lot of experience and success yourself. And as you explore kind of the long history of competitive swimming, you also tell us about the special challenge that came with and still comes with swimming the English Channel. And I wonder if you could just say a quick word about this colorful history and sort of the special allure that has been part of this particular challenge of swimming the English Channel.
Absolutely, it was the Mount Everest of swimming, and it's a really rough thing to swim for a variety of reasons. It's the reason people try to swim from Dover to Calais or Calais to Dover is because it's the narrowest point of the channel, 26 miles, which opens at either end to be, you know, 100 miles. And because it's that neck of the channel, it concentrates tides, it concentrates weather. There are two shipping lanes, one outbound and one inbound. And in between the two shipping lanes, all the jellyfish congregate, including something called the Lion's Mane jellyfish, which is a really, really nasty jellyfish. They swim doubles in length, at least in the early days. It doubles in length because the winds also concentrate there, and they push you in one direction or another. So it was It was the 4 minute mile. It was Mount Everest. It was all these sorts of things combined. And finally, a guy named Matthew Webb, an English sailor, completes a successful swim of the Channel, and becomes immediately the most famous man in the world. This is 1875, and becomes immediately the most famous man in the world. And he has a heart. He has a sad backstory because it turns out he was trying to capitalize on it, and he had no skills really other than being a good sailor and a good swimmer. And he ends up finally sort of desperate and poor and trying to recreate his glory by swimming the Niagara River at the base of the falls, and is killed in about 15 minutes when he does that. Mm. But then the next great crossing of it is done, the first crossing of it by a woman, is Gertrude Ederle, a New Yorker girl. And that name's sort of lost to modern history, I suspect. But Gertrude Ederle became in 1926 really the most famous woman in the world for swimming it. And she did it in a third of the time, not a third of the time, she did it in two-thirds of the time that it took Matthew, sorry, I'm losing my thread here.
Right, yes, on Matthew Webb, yes.
Yeah, Matthew Webb, thank you, yeah, to do it. And she did it by virtue of swimming crawl all the way. Everybody else had tried it swimming breaststroke. Now, it's been swum much faster in the years since because somebody figured out the way you can do it is to just sprint all the way across. The faster you go, the less you get pushed on either side, the less chance there is to get pushed. So it's been done at an extraordinarily fast speed since then. But Gertrude Ederle, when she returns to New York after doing this, and there's been, you know, the world's watching because London is still the journalistic center of the world, and she returns to New York, and they have a ticker tape parade for her, the first parade for a woman, and 2 million people turn out in the streets of New York. I mean, it's an amazing thing to think about in 1926, and she had a little more successful at converting her fame to something else, but she was a swimmer first and foremost, too.
Right. An incredible story. And of course, you touch on the exploits of many other fine swimmers and competitive swimmers. You also talk about how swimming enters the realm of Hollywood in a very big way in the mid-20th century, and touch on many other issues as well. In fact, there's a line in your epilogue that I think is appropriate, which says, as you're talking about your own life as a swimmer and lifeguard, "Swimming can be an education if you let it." And certainly, reading your book is an amazing education in and of itself. I really appreciated how your book is packed with information and beautifully written. Again, it's titled Splash, 10,000 Years of Swimming, published by Hachette, and the author, Howard Means. Howard Means, congratulations on a wonderful book, and thank you for joining me today on The Morning Show to talk about it. I've thoroughly enjoyed this.
Thank you, Greg. Yeah, this is great. I really enjoyed this so much. Take care.
Monday on The Morning Show, you will hear the conversation I've recorded with Sekute Mehta, the author of a very interesting book called This Land Is Our Land. It takes an intriguing look at the whole question of immigration and makes a case for the very rich contribution that immigrants have made to American life throughout our history and continue to contribute to this very, very day. Sekute Mehta himself is an immigrant. And on Tuesday, you'll hear the interview I recorded with Mark Freeman, the author of a brand new oral history about one of the most significant and influential recent comedies, Modern Family, which just ended its run after 11 successful seasons. Support for WGTD comes from Jack and Drea, featuring unique shopping and the historic Jack's Cafe featuring an eclectic menu, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, modernized for a new age. Visit jackandrea.com for more information.